been a fool. I've been a fool. Forgiving you each time you done me wrong. I've been a long time leaving here, but I'll be a long time gone. I say, hi there, highline, hello, highway. Here come a big old semi my way. I stick up my thumb, hear the truck come, but the truck goes by, and it look like he's flying. He's whooping the big legs on my Levi's. They go, whoop, whoop. I've been a fool. I've been a fool. Forgiving you each time you've done me wrong. I've been a long time leaving yet, but I'll be a long time gone. Gone, 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 gone.
Hello, Kaisis family. We are here with another episode. But before we begin, Abraham, how's it going, man?
Good, man. It's been going good. Getting ready for these holidays that are coming up. And got a family trip coming up as well, so excited for that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm going to that too. I guess we're stuck with each other this weekend.
Yeah.
Now, our family has this tradition. Every year we go to this one camp, and they have like these Christmas lights and everything, great activities, everything. It's actually pretty cool. So we're staying for the weekend, but it's a lot of driving. It's not too far from where we live, but it's still like about an hour and a half. So there's going to be a lot of driving because I have, even though we're staying for the whole weekend, I still have work on Saturday. It's going to be waking up early, going to work, going back, and I still have to preach on Sunday. So driving. Anyway, so it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. You know, hanging out with y'all is always fun. So anyways, so this week I want us to talk about doubting the creeds and the confessions. And I feel like whenever I say that, we have to have a disclaimer, right? Just for full clarity, I love the creeds. I love the confessions. Abraham and I, we're not heretics. We just have doubts. And these doubts come in different angles. And I think this might be one of those things. This might be the subject where you and I have different angles, right, Abraham? Mm-hmm. I think you and I are going to come at this at different angles. So I'm going to share mine. And I really want you to share yours. But when it comes to the creeds and the confessions, you know, as Protestants, as coming from this Reformed tradition, we see the scriptures as the primary authority of life and faith, right? So everything else comes is secondary. So creeds, confessions, these are secondary. We would call these things tradition. But the funny thing, Abraham, this is where we all, every Christian tradition, Protestant, Catholic, or whatever, wherever you may be, right? Every tradition is a little quirky, because even though us Protestants, even though us Reformed people, us Presbyterians, despite us saying, you know, that scripture is the ultimate authority for faith and practice, it's interesting the role that the Nicene Creed and like the Westminster Confession and the catechisms, it's interesting that we use them in worship. And I've actually made this point in Sunday school. Any outsider who comes into one of our services and from like we transition from reading a verse in the Psalms to reading the Westminster Confession to reading the Nicene Creed or reading the Shorter Catechism, what are they going to think? Well, they're the same, right? You know, they must have the same authority because we're switching back and forth like it's nothing. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, right? It's just a very interesting thing that we do. We use the Bible and we use documents from our tradition in our worship, and we use them equally sometimes. But I guess the doubt is like, hey, what happens when you start doubting certain parts of the creed and the confession? And I think this is where it gets interesting, because whenever I've gotten mixed responses, and this actually boils down to a church's culture or a denomination's culture. But when you start doubting creeds or doubting the confession, they equate that with doubting the Bible, you know? And is that a good sentiment? I get it to some degree, right? Like if you start saying some like really wacky stuff, like, you know, Jesus is created, you know, I'm so convinced that Jesus is created, then yeah, right? Yeah, that's a little weirder. But what if it's with more secondary things, right? And I guess another angle of the doubt has to do with, you know, I thought, is the Bible enough? And Reformed people Protestants say, well, absolutely, the scripture is the primary authority for life and faith. But if the Bible is enough, why creeds? Why confessions? So it feels awkward. I don't know, Abraham. Have you ever thought about this before?
Yeah, I've shared, you know, that sentiment with some of those things in regards of, you know, people associating it with the Bible, and if you disagree with it, you kind of disagree with the Bible. But also, like, another example would be that in previous churches that I've attended, they didn't really have creeds and confessions, you know, and we were able to participate with our church, you know, perfectly fine without them. And the church, now the church that we go to, we do have creeds and confessions, and we can function with it perfectly fine as well. So I feel like that's where I've had like some doubts, in the sense that, you know, some people overemphasize the use of it. But I'm like, I know I've been in different contexts where it's not used at all, where things still go well. You know, we're still Christian. We still worship the same God, the same triune God and everything. Like, there's still a lot of similarities, but just maybe we don't have those creeds. We don't have those confessions. So that's where I've seen my doubts, the overemphasis of these.
Yeah, definitely there with you too. So for me, okay, first things first, right? Christians who made the creeds and the confessions, they did not think that the Bible was not enough, right? Like, no, I love church history. Y'all know that. Reading the history behind the creeds and the confessions is quite fascinating, because they were made in response to various heresies and problems, right? They're interacting with their geopolitical, social, religious world, and they're responding to specific issues. And there's a side to the creeds and the confessions that are pastoral. You'll notice that the creeds are short, right? The people behind them, these are geniuses. They could have written volumes, but the creeds are short and on purpose, because these are pastoral summaries of truths found in the Bible. Same thing with the confessions. Even though the Westminster Confession is very long, there's a reason why the catechism came through, right? And a shorter catechism, because these are pastoral summaries of truths found in the Bible. Because to be honest, the Bible is a hard book. It's a very hard book, and people don't understand that, you know? It's a very difficult book. One, it's ancient. It's Jewish and Greek. Personally, when it comes to me, I'm disconnected from the Bible by time. You know, I'm 2,000 years after the fact or more. I'm disconnected from the Bible in geography. I'm not even in the place where the Bible was written or where the stories take place. I'm disconnected from the Bible in culture. I'm Mexican, Salvadorian, American. You know, what do we know about ancient Mesopotamian culture, religion, or whatever? And I'm disconnected from the Bible in language. I speak English and Spanish. I don't speak Greek. I don't speak Hebrew. I don't speak Aramaic, right? So all this to say, I understand that the creeds, the confessions, the catechisms, all these are all pastoral tools that are meant to bridge this gap, right? They use the language of our time to communicate biblical truths, right? The same way that pastors, sermons, Sunday schools, these are all meant, the same way that they bridge the gap between the Bible and us, the creeds and the confessions serve a similar purpose, right? So no problem. When you take a closer look at the people who are behind the creeds and the confessions, these are people committed to the Bible. But here's the thing, right? Having said all that, isn't there a danger of focusing so much on the summaries of biblical truth that you dismiss the scriptures accidentally? Like, for me, the analogy that comes into my mind is when I was in college, when I was in my English class, confession time, I did not read most of the books, right? Spark Notes was my friend, right? Spark Notes, bro, they saved my life. They saved my grade. This is the reason why I graduated. I didn't want to read. And I thought these were good summaries. And hey, they actually were, because they gave me what I needed to pass a test or to write an essay. But guess what? I missed out on the book. And I don't think, you know, anyone would say that the Spark Notes are the same thing as the book. Reading the Spark Notes is not the same thing as reading Pride and Prejudice or the Iliad or whatever. So isn't there a danger with doing the same thing with the Bible? where we focus so much on the creeds, where we focus so much on the confession, that we actually miss out on the story of the Bible, on the themes of the Bible, on the motifs, the language of the Bible. Are we so focused on the spark notes that we're missing out on the book? So, Avran, do you see the tension? You know, like, these are good summaries, but isn't there a danger of missing out on the story?
Yeah, I agree with you there. Like you said, the biblical narrative has a lot to tell us that, you know, that summaries don't always capture or contain. And also, just to go on a different route that I feel in a way is a bit related. I think also interacting maybe with non-Christians, you know, they're very curious about what we believe and why we believe it. And so they ask questions, and our answers can come from these, you know, creeds. They can come from these confessions or these catechisms even. But they're very adamant, like, no, we want biblical evidence. Like, I appreciate the summary you have here, but, like, where's the biblical evidence? And I don't know, it happened to me once where I was researching a topic that I found in I believe it was in one of the catechisms. And when I, like, when I looked at the passages it was referencing, I didn't see a lot of parallels. And, you know, obviously, I don't need to be convinced that, you know, that these statements are true or anything like that. But if I were to interact with someone who hasn't interacted with scripture, hasn't interacted with catechisms, and they see that the answer might not be as parallel as it should or as it could be, I feel like that could bring issues, in my opinion, right? I'm like, I don't know. They could complain about the summaries, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just interesting because you want to respect these summaries. And think about it. Like, I feel like every sermon that you hear, in some degree, it's a type of summary of the Bible, right? It's a type of bridge that is meant to connect this ancient text to you, the reader, and make it relevant. Yeah, so, like, I don't want to minimize that, but you're right. I feel like there's a danger where, like, if all I do is just hear sermons or hear creeds, like, there's a slight danger of missing out from like the broader story of the Bible. You know, it's funny, Abraham, when Pastor Todd first came to Cornerstone, one of the things that bothered me is that we stopped reading the Westminster Confession. Like, that used to be part of our corporate reading. And, you know, I feel so guilty about it, but you know what we started reading instead? The Psalms. I don't know if you remember that. Like either a shorter catechism used to be whatever, or part of our corporate reading. Yeah. It was Psalms, and it used to bother me so much. and then, like, with time, I came to understand what he was doing. You know, he was trying to, like, yes, being Reformed, we come from a rich Reformation tradition. That's not a bad thing. It's a beautiful thing. But, you know, you feel like sometimes you need a reality check. Like, hey, let's go back to the roots and the foundation of this Reformation tradition that we have. And that foundation is the Scriptures. So now that it's my turn to prepare the order of worship, I've purposely gone, like, I've been pulpit supplying now for almost a year. I don't think we've ever read, one Sunday we read from the Nicene Creed, but the rest, it's either a psalm or one of the prophets. And it's on purpose, because you want people to reconnect with the foundation that the Reformation, you know, is founded on. So, yeah, you know, it's just like, I guess it's just kind of finding that balance. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So, like, when it comes to the creeds, we talked about confessions a little bit. But with the creeds, another issue that I have with the creeds is with the philosophical language it has. Notice the language of the Nicene Creed. Ousia, upostasis. So I know you don't know Greek, Abraham, but these mean essence and person. You know, like, that Jesus is of the same essence of the Father, but he is a distinct person. So when we speak of the Trinity, we say that, right, there is one essence or one ousia and three persons. And to fully clarify, I fully believe Jesus is God. I'm a full Trinitarian. I don't want to doubt that. But here's my doubt. In order to be a Christian, do I have to accept the ancient philosophical framework of Nicaea? And when I say Nicaea, I mean all the creeds, including Chalcedon. So, I, you know, it's funny, Adam, because I actually ran to a similar issue that you did. When I was talking to my Muslim friends, I realized that not only do I have to show them that Jesus is God from the Bible, but I also have to convince them to accept the philosophical categories of essence and person, of Jesus being consubstantial with the Father. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I have to introduce him to philosophy before I can show them that Jesus is God. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wait, hold up a moment. How did the ancient writers, how did the biblical writers demonstrate that Jesus is God? Because you don't see Luke, you don't see John saying, well, Jesus is usia, is of the same usia of the Father, right? He doesn't say that. He doesn't say that there are three upostases, right? They don't use that language. So it's just weird. Like, to what degree do I have to accept the ancient philosophical framework of Nicaea? You know, once again, I understand that the Nicene Creed was written in a specific context. It was written to the philosophical Greek world. Nicaea was communicating biblical truths within their cultural, linguistic, philosophical, geographical, political context. That I understand. But I wrestle. Because I wrestle with this, because we consider people heretic or Christian depending on whether or not they accept the philosophical language of Nicaea. And we run to the same issue with the Council of Chalcedon, where we speak of the hypostatic union, that within the one person of Jesus, there are two distinct natures, human and divine. They exist within the person of Jesus. They're not confused with one another. But it's weird, because when we see in church history, we see genuine Christians who hold to the Nicene Creed, genuine Christians who are Trinitarian, who believe in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, believe in a second coming, but they're not considered Christian because they don't accept the philosophical language of the Council of Chalcedon. And one of these examples is actually the Nestorians. They accept it, they recognize, and they proclaim that Jesus is fully God and fully human. But they were so uncomfortable with this language of two natures. They didn't like that language of two natures because it sounded like a schizophrenic Jesus, you know? So they were uncomfortable with that. So here's where the doubt is. And it has to do with doubt before. How should we look at history? And how should we look at Christians today? To what extent should the specific language of the creeds determine whether someone is Christian or not? And look, I understand that everyone should accept the biblical truths behind the creeds, but what about the language? I don't know, Abraham. This was like a messy point, and I was rambling a little bit, but am I making any sense here?
Yeah, it just shows how confusing it can get, right? Or how people can get confused. But back to your saying, I do agree that it doesn't always seem fair, right, to a lot of Christians, that for certain groups, they believe that your faith is dependent whether you agree or not with their worldview that's been specified through these creeds. You know what I mean? And like you said, right, first, you can miss out on the biblical story, right, just focusing on this. But then two, looking at Jesus' ministry, like you said, he didn't always use this sort of language, and we were still able to come, you know, to the right conclusions. And also we had help from the apostles, right, to explain Jesus' teachings to us as well. But, you know, I don't know, some of these standards regarding what makes you a Christian can be pretty concerning, you know, and it's not that we want to diminish the use of creeds or anything like that. But I don't know, emphasizing certain aspects or certain uses of it can lead down a tricky road, in my opinion.
Yeah, dude, because have you ever tried talking with someone about usia, hypostasis, hypostatic union, right? And it sucks because it's like, technically, if you get any of those wrong, you're technically a heretic, right? And I'm like, bro, it's so unfair. Like, imagine, in my imagination, if I ever talk to my grandma, my poor grandma, who grew up in like a small town in Mexico in the mountains, you know, if I ever try to get in an argument with her about these things, it's like, hey, if you don't agree with the specific philosophical categories, you're technically a heretic. And it's just like, Yeah, no, I love church history. I see the value, the infinite value. Infinite is an exaggeration, but yeah, you know what I mean. Like that these creeds have the history. They were perfect for their time. They have huge relevance for us today, but it's just like, it's just that weird tension, you know, to what degree. But another issue, another doubt that I have, not just with the confessions, but also with like, you know, sorry, not just with the creeds, but it's also with the confessions in the Book of Church Order. Now, this doubt has more to do with culture, with the culture of a church or denomination surrounding these confessions. To what degree am I allowed to disagree with a confession? Because it's not the Bible. To what degree am I allowed to fellowship with a church or denomination? You know, some of you know, right, that I disagree with the Westminster on a couple areas. And full disclosure, I love the Westminster. I think it's an awesome summary of Christian doctrine. I still reference it when I'm like struggling to summarize or to like understand certain points. I use it as a reference. It's great. But I disagree on some points of it. Like, you know, when it comes to creation, I don't believe in a literal 6 days. And I feel like the confession does lean towards a literal 6 day creation. I disagree with the issue of Sabbath. I don't think that Sunday is the new Sabbath personally. I disagree with our certain parts of our Book of Church Order, right? I believe that women can be in ministry. Our church order book says just no, right? And, you know, it's crazy because, like, I understand that certain parts of the confession, the Westminster, certain parts of the Book of Church Order, some of those things are clearly in the Bible, right? But the weird part is that depending where you are to disagree with these confessions or the Book of Church Order, to disagree with them is to disagree with the Bible. And by the way, I'm not talking about my church. Our church is like super chill. If I understand correctly, I think only the leadership, it is expected of the leadership, right, to hold to the Westminster Confession. And especially our church in our denomination, right, they recognize that the Westminster is up to a lot of interpretation. So they're very flexible when it comes to the members. You can openly disagree with the Westminster, with the confession, as long as there's, you know, general unity and order is maintained. That's why I love our church, right? The diversity of people, you get everybody there. When I first got to Cornerstone of Run, they asked me, right, is there anything you disagree with us? And I was like, infant baptism. I think that's whack, you know. I was convinced otherwise later, right? But it's so funny because they were like, oh, as long as you're willing to learn and not make a big deal about it, right? I think the diversity of people enriches the church. But here's a weird tension, Oran. I understand that these confessions and the Book of Church Order, these are important for the day-to-day of every church. They have huge practical consequences. But at the same time, to what degree should these confessions and the Book of Church Order, to what degree should they dictate fellowship? It's funny, Abraham, because I'm not asking you to resolve this right here, but like think about it for a second. Like me and you would recognize that infant baptism is a secondary issue, right? It's like it's not you're not a Christian or a heretic depending on where you land on this. Mm-hmm. But think about it on a practical level. If someone was like does not want to baptize their kids, or I think it's easier to make this case if you're in a Baptist church, right? If they're like, oh, it's not a big deal, secondary issue. What happens when you want to baptize your kid, right? That's when it gets practical. That's when you're like, oh, this is low-key important for some degree of fellowship, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, it's crazy. I understand that these have huge practical consequences, but to what degree should these confessions or church order dictate fellowship? I don't know. Have you wrestled with this? Or is it just me?
No, yeah, for sure. And like you said, but having been part of different churches, right, you do see that diversity and you see how churches can function with or without, you know, creeds or confessions. So sometimes seeing a culture that leans too heavily towards the use of creeds and confessions, it does throw me off a little bit, right? Just based off of experience, right? I've seen it work without, or I've seen it work with less emphasis. So someone trying to say like, no, it can't work without, that's that's like my red flag, right?
Yeah,
that's why I raised the red flag in that scenario.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, and I feel it's very case to case, though, right? You do have to interact with people. You have to figure out what they believe in and why. And so, because I don't think like we're not trying to overgeneralize, right? That all these whoever uses them, that's their culture. No. I think like you said, mentioning our church, very very healthy in that area. But you do meet certain people that differ with our views or my views. And that's where concerns come up sometimes.
Yeah. And just to remind you, like these are just doubts, right, that we wrestle with. It's just thoughts and things that we wrestle with. Like I love Jesus. I love the Bible. And I sometimes feel like creed, confession, book of just order, it interferes with the simplicity and beauty of the Christian faith. And look once again, I understand that creeds and confessions are important tools that help summarize the big book of the Bible. And that's the hard part. You see their value, you see their importance, but you also see the danger, you know? But yeah, Bran. So it's just one of those things where you just want to throw this question to someone else. Just like, let someone else wrestle with it, right? Any final thoughts, Bran, as we wrap up?
Yeah. And, you know, whenever you said to see them as tools, I feel like we should use them accordingly, right? Use them as tools, yeah, but also be willing to put them away, right? You don't always have to use the same tool over and over and over. Using that analogy, right? And then also, you know, upholding these writings shouldn't, you know, determine your faith, right? I feel like the church survived without them, and with them, they've also received a lot of help, right? So, like, a lot of good has come out from this. But also, there was a time where the church didn't have them and was, you know, and God still sustains his church. I believe that believers can go with or without them, right? And we just got to be, you know, loving and friendly with each other, right? Understanding that we have different views, different values, and that's okay. You know, at the end of the day, that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. You know, I love church history. So what I'm going to, my encouragement to all of y'all is just like, look, use all the resources that you can. You use the creeds, use the confessions. We come from a great Christian tradition, not just a great Reformation tradition, but we come from a great Christian tradition. You know, God has worked throughout the ages and through many people. But at the end of the day, like to continue using your analogy around, like, these are all tools at the end of the day. So let us like approach these sober-mindedly. That as great as a tool can be, it's still a tool at the end of the day. And it's always, I'm gonna say this as a good Protestant, right? At the end of the day, everything goes under the scriptures, right? The authoritative scriptures that we've inherited from of old. So yeah. It's good to hear, Abraham, that I'm not the only one that's wrestling with this. So thank you so much, Abraham, for going through this exercise with me. But I just want to let our audience know that we're going to take a break for 2 weeks for the holidays. You know, we're gonna be busy. So we'll come back after that. So have a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. I've been a fool. I've been a long time leaving yet, but I'll be a long time gone, 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 gone.